there's no name yet for Harry and Meghan's newborn son.
There is a name!
For Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSN.
Thanks, Ollie. There is a name. There's been a name. There's been a name announced. How you doing? Welcome to Wednesday's Richie Allen Show. It's approaching 3 minutes past five. Good to be with you. Terrific guests lined up today. Lots to talk about as usual. Welcome to your Richie Allen Show.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show.
Yes, welcome indeed. You have named the baby. The baby has been named as Archie Harrison Mountbatten Windsor. Archie Harrison Mountbatten Windsor. Did you hear that, Tom?
No. Could you repeat it? Because I can't believe my fucking ears.
Yeah, it's Archie Harrison Mountbatten Windsor. Parasite in the making. Welcome
it's
to the show.
The Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Yeah, welcome to the program. Twitter, as usual, is the way to reach me during the show. I am really, really looking forward to this program. A couple of gentlemen coming on the show today that have not been on before. Dr. E. Michael Jones, the editor of culturewars.com. He's written many books, including The Slaughter of Cities and Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control. We're going to talk about the sexual revolution as a control mechanism, amongst other things that should be interesting. Dr. E. Michael Jones joins me a bit later on in the programme. Before that, we're going to be talking about Venezuela, and I'll be joined by Dr. Alan McLeod. Alan is an academic and author. He's written Propaganda in the Information Age and Bad News from Venezuela. I think he's a top man. Came across him on RT, and he spoke very eloquently. He writes very eloquently about propaganda, and it's very, very timely, very prescient, I would have said. Alan McLeod joins the programme this hour. So you're welcome to it, and there are a few things to get through in the first 20-25 minutes, as usual. Before that, though, I want to mention I'm from Waterford City, Port Lauriga, and I'm proud to be from Waterford City, from Ballybeg in Waterford, later on Browns Road. And one of Waterford's most beloved sons, if I can say that, because it might sound like a bit of a cliche, but a great gentleman called Shamey Code, a great Waterford man, fair to say universally liked back home, but not just back home, around Ireland and beyond, was a great, great footballer, former professional footballer, who played for Waterford and won multiple leagues and trophies and represented his country, and he was a coach. But primarily he was a dad and a family man first and foremost. Now, I didn't know Shamey that well, only to meet him and bump into him and say hello to him. And he was always a gentleman. But I'm very close friends with his son, Nigel, who's a great old friend of mine, Nigel. And I went to school with his sister, Laura, Shamey's daughter. I was in high school with Laura, and we shared pretty much every class for 6 years. It's been a difficult year for the Codes, and Shamey's son, David, Nigel's brother, died tragically last year in a freak accident. That was a very difficult time for the family as well. But I just wanted to mention them today because they're great people. And this particular programme is picked up in Waterford by a pretty sizable audience because of, you know, obviously I come from Waterford and I worked in radio in Waterford for some years as well. But Shamey Code is a great man. His family are lovely people. And I want to say Shamey Code or Yeshde Gareva on him and extend my condolences to Nigel, his mother, Helena, Laura, and Gary, and the rest of the family. All right, great people. Let's have a look at one or two of the quirkier things in the news today. A Cambridge University college has removed a historic bell from view. A bell now. Not a painting or a dedication or a plaque, but a bell from view because of fears that it has links to the slave trade. So that's a bell. Yes, a bell has been removed from Cambridge Uni because of fears, mind, that it has links to the slave trade.
What kind of fuckery is this?
I don't know. I don't know what the bell, Amy, could have done to anybody. It did something to someone. This is the Demerara bell. It was given to St. Catherine's College by a former student who went to work for a sugar company in British Guyana. So the bell has to come down. In April, Cambridge announced it would have a 2-year investigation into its own links with slavery, and a spokesperson for St. Catherine's College said the bell most likely came from a slave plantation. They don't know this to be true, but just in case it did, well, we better take it down, lest somebody walk past the bell and die of, I don't know, sorrow or shame or humiliation or whatever. That's a true story. The bell was initially hung in a belfry outside the Porter's Lodge, but was moved to an accommodation block in the early 90s. A spokesperson for the college said, as part of the ongoing reflection taking place about the links between universities and slavery, we are aware that a bell currently located at the college probably came from a slave plantation. A more detailed investigation is now underway into the bell's provenance as part of a wider project researching links to the slave trade. And they quoted a woman called Dr. Miranda Griffin, senior tutor in Cambridge. And Miranda said, it is important that the college, along with the rest of the collegiate university, acknowledges historical links to slavery and the slave trade. But dear listener, you know I'm no genius. I've never claimed to be otherwise. But surely an argument could be made that if you remove the bell, the fucking bell, aren't you erasing your links to slavery, if there are any links? Couldn't be argued that you're in fact covering up the links. I don't know. To a little bit of Brexit. The Prime Minister has rejected calls for her to quit again over her handling of Brexit, saying it's not an issue about me. She was replying to Andrea Jenkins, the Tory Brexiteer, who said May had failed to deliver on her promises and had lost the public trust that she should go. Go now. Be gone. These calls for her to leave have been ongoing, of course. May did say that she would see out Brexit and she would then leave. Yeah. Nigel Farage was on the Good Morning Britain programme this morning with Susanna Reid and Piers Morgan. Got to be careful not to say Corbyn. I'd love Piers Corbyn to be presenting Good Morning Britain. That'd be interesting. But Piers Morgan and Susanna Reid primarily spoke with Farage in the first of a series of interviews with the party leaders around the European parliamentary elections, which take place on May 23rd, this was announced. We knew it was happening, of course, that there would be EU elections. It was rubber stamped and made official, of course, yesterday. Wasn't it yesterday? I don't know what day it is. When you've had a bank holiday in a week, I don't know where we are. But anyway, May said she would make way for a new leader, blah, blah, blah. Nigel Farage was asked about UKIP. I thought Farage would be asked about claims that his appearances on Alex Jones's InfoWars programme denounced him as anti-Semitic, but they didn't get into that. They wanted to ask him, of course, about UKIP and Carl Benjamin and those tweets about Jess Phillips. This is what Farage said about his long association with UKIP.
It was part of my life for 25 years. I warned them last year repeatedly, do not let the lunatic fringe, do not let the criminal fringe into the party. Piers, they ignored me. On a personal level, I feel slightly sad that it's happened. But frankly, the sooner this election's over with and UKIP closes down, the better it will be. It's gone beyond a joke.
Isn't it pretty disgusting that this person is even allowed to putting himself up?
It's extraordinary. You know, these comments are vile.
I mean, you've been on the receiving end of a lot of vile stuff yourself.
Yeah.
The toxic nature of this Brexit debate for 3 years now has, I think, turned this country into just this screaming cesspit where people on either side just think it's perfectly legitimate to use the most abusive language about each other. How do we get through this? How do we get back to a country that engages in democratic debate without this howling rage?
Well, you just ignore it, is what you do. You don't pay any attention to it, you could argue.
The reason we're in this mess is because so many in the establishment refused to accept the result. You know, from Nick Clegg to Tony Blair to Anna Soubry, they refused to accept the result. As opposed to in a normal democracy, you say, look, I don't like it, but I accept it. What we have to do is we have to get Brexit done, leave the European Union, and very quickly after that, people will accept that it's done and we'll move on.
Nigel Farage, we'll leave Brexit for now. We'll leave it there for now. Donald Trump has said that the billions of dollars lost by his businesses in the 80s and 90s were for tax purposes. This is a very important story, this. It speaks to how sometimes how close the corporate media gets to understanding where true power lies, but then they back off. It's an important story. Now, Trump's been tweeting because the New York Times published an article claiming that from 85 to 95, he made losses of over $1 billion. The truth is he lost a lot more than that. But anyway, the NYT, the New York Times, said Trump's property empire continued to lose money every year, totaling over $1 billion in losses for the decade. So Trump, of course, immediately took to Twitter, as he does, to shout and rant, saying, "You always wanted to show losses," meaning him, "your business wants to show losses and often renegotiate with banks. It's a sport," said Trump. "So these losses and reporting of them are a strategic choice by businesses like mine," said Trump, "to renegotiate banks. It was a sport." And then he went on to say, did the hairpiece, that the stories are fake news. And this is a new era, of course, because in this wonderful era we've inherited or we've inhabited or entered into, when you are caught bang to rights, not just Trump but anybody, you can just scream fake news and your supporters will say, "Yeah, Trump, 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 MAGA, 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 MAGA," rather than look into it and say, "Well, hang on a second, even a broken clock is right twice a day. What's the truth?" The truth is Trump is a bankster-controlled puppet and has been for decades. This is the truth. It's not conjecture. And if you want to learn about this, the wonderful Dean Henderson blogs about this at hendersonlefthook.wordpress.com. That's hendersonlefthook.wordpress.com. Dean is brilliant. And he's written articles about Trump's purchasing of Resorts International back in 1987. Now, that was a CIA front, by the way, Resorts International. It really was. It was founded by Alan Dulles and David Rockefeller in the 50s. Trump also went on to buy the Atlantic City Taj Mahal Casino in New Jersey from Resorts International, and he began to buy up lots of other properties in Atlantic City. This is mid to late 80s. But very soon he found himself in serious trouble. His cash was gone, it had dried up, and he couldn't pay the debt on the loans that he had taken out. Who helped him out? A guy called Wilbur Ross. You know who Wilbur Ross is? Billionaire bond trader. Worked for Rothschild Inc. for many, many years. Okay? And he bailed out Trump. How did he do that? Well, he renegotiated these loans and left Trump in control of this Resorts International and the Taj Mahal Casino. But he also persuaded, did Ross, Deutsche Bank to give Trump billions of dollars through the 90s, even though Trump defaulted several times on those loans. Right? That Taj Mahal deal that Ross did when Trump couldn't pay the interest on these loans was basically to restructure these agreements, leaving Trump still in control with a 50% stake in Atlantic City Taj Mahal. And he got better debt terms, but he remained in control ultimately, saved face, and eventually managed to get back onto the Forbes 400 richest list. This is true. And Wilbur Ross, you know who Wilbur Ross is, of course, don't you? Do I have to tell you who Wilbur Ross is and the part that he plays and has played in Trump's administration? It was Rothschild Inc. who told Ross to fix this for Trump and who eventually told Deutsche Bank to bankroll Donald Trump for 2 decades, even though Trump kept defaulting. So the media is so close to who's really pulling the strings of puppets like Donald Trump, but they back off, they only go so far. All right? Because the media plays the game. The US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is in London. He met Theresa May and then he held a press conference with Jeremy Hunt, the Foreign Secretary. There were threats for Iran and China and, of course, Venezuela. And we're going to be talking Venezuela really soon with Alan McLeod. Listen to Pompeo talk about Maduro, but also Pompeo talks about those in the UK and the US who support Maduro in Venezuela. This is Mike Pompeo. After Pompeo finishes speaking, you'll hear a 20-second snip of UK Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt.
It is disgusting to see leaders in not only the United Kingdom, but in the United States as well, who continue to support the murderous dictator, Maduro. And it is not in either of our country's best interest for those leaders to continue to advocate on their behalf. The Venezuelan people have spoken through their constitutional mechanism. They have put Juan Guaido as their interim president, that he is the duly elected leader there. And Maduro is on borrowed time. And to see American leaders or leaders from this country continue to provide support and comfort to a regime that has created so much devastation, so much destruction. I was in Colombia. I saw those families who had to make choices about whether to feed their children on even days or odd days. That is a direct result of Nicolas Maduro, and no leader in a country with Western democratic values ought to stand behind them.
Yeah, you wouldn't expect anything less from Pompeo. What did Jeremy Hunt have to say? Foreign Secretary.
This is a country where 3 million people have fled the country. GDP has gone down by 40% in the last 4 years. People can't access basic medicine. People are rifling through rubbish bags to get food in the streets. And John McDonald describes this as socialism in action. And I think people need to draw their own conclusions about what his own plans might be for the UK.
Short and sweet. There was some talk about Yemen, not much, though. Reluctant were Pompeo and Hunt to talk about the Saudi Arabian genocide in Yemen, which is ongoing as we speak. Welcome to the Richie Allen Show. Hi to William in Scotland. He says, Richie, what about real slavery, like the child slavery being carried out by the likes of Nike and other major manufacturers and so-called leading nations? It's a good point, that. Absolutely. Hi to Martin in Spain, to David, who tweets, next they will be branding Rate and Loyal from the campus, just in case. This is referring to the Cambridge University story. They're banning Rate and Loyal from the campus, just in case. This is the story of Cambridge University thinking about removing a bell from one of the colleges because the bell might have come from a plantation. So they're not even sure, but you know, you never know. Just to be on the safe side. Maybe we should divest ourselves of everything that's older than 90 years, just in case, you know, that some hand was taken in building it or making it. Everything you have that's very old, every bit of furniture that's a century old, you never know, some slave trader might have passed his hand over it sometime, and you don't want to be tainted by that. Hi to Charlotte in Burnley. How you doing, Charlotte in Burnley? Hi to Andy Newman as well, to Cartoon Drunk, to Liz Jones, to everybody who's tweeting the programme. We'll take a very quick musical interlude and I will get Andy McLeod. Excuse me, I will get Dr. Alan McLeod on the line. He's an author and I want to talk to him about the propaganda war by the media on Venezuela. It's all too easy to criticise and castigate puppets like Pompeo and Jeremy Hunt for what it is they say about Venezuela. But what about the media? What about The Guardian? What about The Independent? We used to rely on The Guardian, didn't we? Many years ago in The Independent, to put the other side of this as the state media, the BBC and The Telegraph would give you these horror stories from Iraq and from Venezuela and places like that. Didn't we depend on The Guardian and The Independent? Maybe we don't depend on them so much anymore. Music from Harry Nilsson. And after Harry Nilsson, we'll talk Venezuela with Alan McLeod. This is your Richie Allen Show. Welcome to it. Of my mind. Harry Nilsson on the Richie Allen Show. The time is 24 minutes past the hour. Lots and lots of tweets. Of course, David was referring to Tate and Lyle. I just read it without even thinking. Yeah, we'll get into that again later on. We'll get into it again in the week, next week. It's a serious issue, that, I think. But anyway, you heard in the monologue there, you heard from Mike Pompeo, the US Secretary of State. He's in London. And in a press conference with Jeremy Hunt, the Foreign Secretary, he took a few broadsides at Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, and his lieutenant, I suppose, his shadow chancellor, John McDonnell, about their support for Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela. We've been covering this, of course, extensively since since things started hotting up this year, but we've been covering this forever, on this programme. And I'm delighted to welcome to the show an academic and author, a gentleman who's written Propaganda in the Information Age, but also Bad News from Venezuela, which is about the media's 20-year-long war on Venezuela. I first came across him on RT's Going Underground programme in the winter and was due to drop him a mail to invite him on, but then I got sick and I was out of action for a few weeks. But I'm glad that he's here now. His voice on this issue is very important. Let's welcome to the programme Dr. Alan McLeod. Alan, thanks so much for giving us your time. How are you?
Good to be with you, Richie. I'm good.
Thanks for doing it. I really appreciate that. I suppose no surprise that Mike Pompeo and Jeremy Hunt were firing broadsides at Jeremy Hunt and, Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell today. I mentioned towards the end of my monologue, there was a time, wasn't there, when we did have plurality, when you could look to maybe The Guardian, maybe The Independent, for more balance and, you know, a more circumspect look at the problems of Latin America and what's going on in Venezuela. But those days are gone. But a listener said to me that I'm very naive, that it's not a recent thing, that you're absolutely right and that there hasn't been any fair reporting on Latin America or Venezuela for far longer than I'm even prepared to admit. What do you think?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I studied the media coverage of Venezuela since 1998, and I found that across the spectrum, the media overwhelmingly presented very small, shallow views on the country, which were very much in the minority of the opinion rather than the majority, and were not even backed up by the facts. So, for instance, even The Guardian pretty much tacitly endorsed the 2002 coup against Hugo Chavez, Maduro's predecessor. There is a little bit of debate in The Guardian. You can see some more nuanced coverage there sometimes. But in general, the difference between the right-wing press like The Telegraph and The Guardian tends to be more over tone rather than actual substance. And that's because it's pretty much the same people writing the same articles there.
How does that happen? Now, I watched your interview with Afshin Ratanzi, I hope I said that right, and I'm brutal for pronouncing names, forgive me. And it was excellent. I think he's an excellent presenter. It was an excellent interview. And I'm going to put my MSM hat on me, and I'm going to be a mainstream presenter. Because this is what they should do. You should be on the BBC, you should be on ITV, you should be on Channel 4. But of course, you're not, and we know why you're not. But I'll do that. Couple of quick questions then. Was the election, the most recent election of Nicolas Maduro, was it fair?
Well, you don't need to take my advice for it. You can just look at the numerous international bodies that covered the election. So, for instance, the African Union, the Caribbean Community, and the Council of Latin American Electoral Experts. And they all came back and produced reports on the election and said that the election was indeed free and fair. And in fact, the worst criticism of their election in those reports was that some polling stations were not on the ground floor, meaning some disabled or elderly people had trouble voting. And if that's the worst thing about your election, I think you're doing pretty well. In fact, President Jimmy Carter, former president of the US, said of the election system in Venezuela, it was the best in the world in 2012. And not that much has changed about it since then.
Yeah, he said that, didn't he, when Barack Obama was in the White House. I remember that. Before we get into more on what's actually going on in Venezuela, back to that original question, I go around in circles sometimes. Why is the coverage and why are the articles so similar? I was fascinated reading you, and I'm going to tweet out links to where people can read you as well, Alan, because I think you've got a really, really spot on and unique take on how we get to this stage. How do we get journalists writing for various broadsheets, which are supposed to be competing with one another for readers, for circulation? How are the articles so similar in tone? How does that happen?
Well, we've had massive cuts in funding for journalism ever since the rise of the internet. And so what happens is big newspapers like The Guardian, The Telegraph, The Times, the BBC or what have you, have actually just outsourced all of their reporting on foreign issues, particularly in Latin America, which they see as a backwater. They've outsourced them to local Venezuelan journalists or freelancers who live over there. And all of these people live in the same gated communities in the very wealthy part of eastern Caracas. They all interact with each other. Sometimes they're in relationships with each other. They live in the same buildings, and they basically have the same outlook on the world because they imbibe the same people, talk to the same sources. And very often it's the same people writing one day in The Guardian, the next day in The New York Times, and the next day for the BBC. So that's really the problem. There's only a couple of, maybe two dozen people for the entire Western media that are actually producing the content that we see. So there's such a limited range of opinions out there.
And that's why it's almost a kind of a unified approach from the UK media. I've said to one or two of Maduro's critics that are prepared to debate on social media, to be fair to them, you know, they've talked about brutal dictator. And I've made a point that you've kind of hinted at there. I've said, well, these opposition figures, these people who work with Western media agencies and Western governments, you don't see them disappearing or being kidnapped or taken away in the middle of the night, footsteps and screams. They're still there. If this guy was the horrifying monster that we're told he is, surely he'd be dealing with these people, right?
Sure. I mean, I've got umpteen criticisms of Maduro if you want to hear them, but the fact of the matter is that he's survived multiple coup attempts, assassination attempts, and right now we've got a guy who's never been elected, never even stood for election in Juan Guaido, who is openly calling for the United States to invade the country and has tried multiple times to overthrow the supposedly dictatorial president. And yet he's got complete free rein to just walk around the city with his megaphone and try to convince the army to overthrow the elected president. It's incredible.
It is incredible, yeah. Speak a little bit to your criticisms of Maduro. I'm a big fan of people like Hugo Chavez and what he attempted to do, the Bolivarian Revolution. And I've always, that's where I come from. I come from a trade union background in Ireland. And what I think of as kind of genuine old socialism, not social democracy, but old socialism. So I like what these guys try to do. I can't hide that bias. That's how I feel about it. But some of my friends in the independent media, some of them who come on, capitalists, some of them, they say, Richie, whatever about what they're trying to do, the policies, and whatever about the external pressure of the United States and sanctions, of course, and we can talk about those and the impact of them on Venezuela. They say that these policies ultimately don't work and that people like Chavez and Maduro are stubborn in not realizing that they don't work. And maybe they're the architects of their own downfall, or maybe they're at least partly responsible for the problems they find themselves in. Do you have any truck with that argument that the policies just don't work, even without the interference from the West?
Well, I think in a vacuum, we can be critical of Maduro but also pointing out that the fact that the United States, the biggest power in the world, is openly trying to dethrone Maduro and try to submarine the economy. But I think Chavez certainly had a very ad hoc mercurial style, where he'd look at a problem and change his policy, whereas Maduro just doesn't have the same charisma and the same level of authority as Chavez. So he's found it very difficult to unite all the disparate factions of the ruling coalition, which means that he's really been stuck in a stasis for a number of years. So he's not really been able to promote policies that would deal with the inflation, for instance, or the problems with speculation and hoarding. I think if Chavez was about, he would have done a bit of a better job in that. But as you said, it's very difficult to disassociate this these failings of the government, which have been pointed out by many leftists as well.
It's a tragedy. Sorry to interrupt you. It's a tragedy. If you were right, and if Maduro is fundamentally decent, and he is motivated by good, and he wants to continue the policies of lifting people out of poverty and fairness and nationalizing, you know, using the assets of the country for the betterment of everybody, it's a real tragedy then if he doesn't have the intellectual nous, or if he doesn't have the people around him to help him. Because I think you're onto something here, Alan, to be honest, to be able to help him shift strategy and change and kind of evolve, right?
Yeah, I mean, in 2016, a group of economists from UNISUR, the Union of South American Nations, most of them leftists, actually, who've had the ear of the Chavez government, presented him with a plan to deal with the economic problems he's facing. But unfortunately, the government refused to implement any of them. So it's really been an extraordinarily static government for the last few years, and that's really hurt the economy. Now, I would say that Maduro had to take over in very tough economic times. One thing that's not talked about is the entire region of Latin America is going through a serious crisis and a huge economic decline because the products that they create for the world market, like primary products like, you know, tin, coal, zinc, copper, foods like bananas, etc., have absolutely flatlined in terms of price. So it's a very difficult time. You do have to give Maduro quite a lot of credit for not implementing austerity as many other governments in Europe, for instance, have done.
That's really good, that. And these difficulties that Latin America is having generally that you've outlined there, market manipulation, is that something that's happening? You know, prices being artificially manipulated to put more and more pressure on these countries because massive conglomerates want to get their hands and want to get their businesses in there to privatize water and everything else? Or is that simplistic?
Well, I mean, absolutely, that is going on. If we take oil, for example, the United States has been working quite closely with Saudi Arabia to make sure they overproduce oil and then drop the price. One of the main reasons Chavez was able to reduce poverty in Venezuela by 50% and extreme poverty by 75% was that he actually reinvigorated the oil-producing OPEC cartel, which managed to raise prices of oil from $9 a barrel in 1999 to $140 in 2008. And that was really the source of the wealth that he managed to create this incredible welfare state out of almost nothing.
Loads of tweets. There are loads of tweets on this. By the way, you can follow Alan on Twitter. It's Dr. Alan McLeod. Alan is an author, and his books, Propaganda in the Information Age and Bad News from Venezuela, are must reads. They really are. You don't get too many books these days that are critiquing the media like that, so check them out. And Alan, as I said, is on Twitter. You can follow him there. It's at Alan R. McLeod. Follow him if you haven't done before. Alan, let's read this from Patricia in Zurich. Richie, nobody is suggesting Maduro is a great guy, but he was elected by the people. The US wants him out. Why? Maybe it's because they want his oil. Guaido is just another American puppet. It's so obvious. Who is this guy, Guaido?
Right. Well, as Patricia pointed out, he is very much linked to the United States. He got his start in politics in the student protests of 2007. He went over to the United States to be trained in Washington. He went to, I think it was George Mason University. His party has been funded for pretty much since its inception by the U.S. In January, there was a poll showed that more than 80% of Venezuelans didn't know who he was. But then in late January, he decided that he was the self-appointed president. And so he challenged Maduro, that failed, and now he's challenged them again in May. And that's really what he's about. In terms of his policy, he's presented himself as a sort of left-wing social democrat. But when you actually look at his political party, Popular Will, their policies are right to extreme right, especially on terms of social policy, where many of their leaders espouse openly racist threads, and they've had a number of campaigns where they would go around white mobs lynching black people, even burning black people in the streets, roasting them to death as part of their campaign to try to force Maduro out. So really, when you look at his politics and his background, he's not really the sort of mild social democrat or center leftist he presents himself as.
Andy tweets, pompous Mike Pompeo is one of the world's most dangerous men, along with Yosemite Bolton. He has put some hawks, hasn't he, in his cabinet, Donald Trump. And of course, we know these guys of old. How dangerous are these guys, Alan? They will be pushing pretty hard for some sort of, I reckon, military action in Venezuela. I keep an eye out for a couple of right-wing news shows in America, one of them being Tucker Carlson at Sky News, because I don't think he's so right-wing. I think he's more centrist in his approach. And I liked a program he did recently where he was playing clips of senators and governors from various states in the US all endorsing some sort of military action against Venezuela. And to his credit, Tucker Carlson was horrified by the notion of it. These guys, Pompeo and Bolton, they're obviously very influential. They'll be pushing hard for military action. How realistic is that, do you think?
Yeah, they certainly will be pushing for it. Right now, I think unless they can try to turn the Venezuelan military, which is proven to be extremely loyal to the government, I think the actual possibility of an invasion seems quite unlikely right now. That's just to say, because if we look at the history of American interventions in other countries, they tend to only attack powerless countries, whereas the Venezuelan military is actually it's certainly very large and reasonably modern. But certainly if we look at people like Elliot Abrams, one of Trump's men, his history in Latin America really is gruesome when you look at the genocides that he was helping to oversee in the regions like Central America and Honduras, Guatemala, etc. in the 1980s. So the stakes could barely be higher for Latin America right now.
Some of our listeners are making the point, it's very ironic for Jeremy Hunt to be talking about dictators and banana republics and all the rest of it, when regardless of what you feel about Europe or membership of Europe, the fact is people did take a vote to leave the EU back in 2016, and this government has pretty much done all it can to ignore that decision. Do you take that as a fair point, regardless of your own personal feelings on the EU? What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And we could even go further than that. I mean, dictator tends to be a word that's thrown about in politics a lot, but it's really a code word for government we don't like, because at the same time as Jeremy Hunt appears to be outraged by the dictatorship of Nicolas Maduro, he's signing deals with the dictatorship in Saudi Arabia. So it's completely self-serving, this rhetoric.
Yeah, it was amazing today. They skipped over, I don't know if you saw the press conference, very little mention of Yemen, and straight to China and Iran and Venezuela. Dr. Alan McLeod is our guest. We've got Alan for another 10 or 15 minutes. Really glad to meet you, Alan. Thanks for coming on the programme. Check out Propaganda in the Information Age and Bad News from Venezuela. These are important reads. They really are in this age of media. And we'll talk a little bit about the media now for a minute if we can, because you talked when you were on Going Underground, which is a very good programme. I recommend people check it out. You talked about the media being basically an agency collectively brainwashing and propagandizing us. That's a devastating outlook for where we are in 2019 as people, as citizens, when we have a media that isn't there holding the feet to the fire of these people, our governments, but they're there to brainwash and propagandize us. That's very depressing, Alan.
Well, the media is not your friend. The media are perhaps the most powerful force in society, shaping what we think is possible, what we think is impossible, what we think is practical, in terms of what we even think about as a possibility to shape our society. And for the most part, media is highly concentrated in the hands of just a few people. So, for instance, only five companies in the US control over 90% of what Americans read or see on television. And that has huge effects for the sort of the level of discourse that we have in society. An informed public is absolutely the cornerstone, the bedrock of any democracy. And if we don't have that, then we can't really call ourselves a democracy.
Very good point you make there. My career was in commercial and national media. And I used to think when I started out as a producer that I had a pretty awesome responsibility. Now, I didn't go all James Bond villain with that. I just thought to myself, wow, you're producing a two-hour current affairs radio show a day. It's got a very big audience. And I got to decide, Alan, what we talked about on that given day, but more importantly, of course, and you know more about this than most, what we didn't talk about. And that used to keep me up nights thinking about it. And on that point, on Alan's point, didn't Jeffrey Sachs of Columbia University, didn't he co-author a report, a very detailed report in the last couple of weeks that says, and he's a noted economist, by the way, that says that US sanctions have been responsible for tens of thousands of deaths in Venezuela. And this is a credible man. And yet, apart from Amy Goodman on Democracy Now, and apart from Russia Today to its credit, nobody else has spoken about that report.
Well, I think it really shows what the media are about when you look at these sorts of facts. Jeffrey Sachs is one of the world's most famous and storied economists, whatever you think of him. And he did author that report, which showed that around 40,000 Venezuelans have died as a result of Trump's sanctions. And that's just between August 2017 and December 2018. And yet there has been virtually no pickup of this in the press. You'd expect that the press, who talk about how much they are concerned about Venezuelan human rights and the Venezuelan people who are apparently starving, although that's highly debatable, you'd think that this would be front page news around the world. But in fact, no national outlet in the United States picked it up. And there was only one report in the Independent in the UK. So these sorts of facts really show the priorities of the media and what they're really, truly about.
And it's interesting, they go after people who make appearances in the Independent media. There's a Sheffield academic I'm sure you'll know all about him, Piers Robinson. And they went after him big time, claiming that he was a pro-Assad propagandist. The irony of it, the guy might be, his opinions might be very subjective, but they're worthy of, you know, at least a hearing anyway. But they really went to town on the guy, to the point where he's left Sheffield University. I don't want to be trying to score points with my audience or getting all melodramatic, but that's fascism, isn't it? If an academic has to leave his job because, you know, the media come after him, and this is a media that is kind of perpetuating and pushing propaganda 24/7.
You know, one of the weird things about our upside down world right now is that the people who are demanding people are censored and can't speak out are not those at the top of politics, but they tend to be journalists themselves that are saying that. And I find that really remarkable in this day and age. And this is really a problem that's been with us from time immemorial. If you wanted to oppose, say, the Iraq War or the Gulf War, you were labeled an apologist for Saddam. Or if you didn't want to see war with Iran, that meant you loved the Ayatollah. And now if you want to critique the media or just say no to another intervention in Venezuela, you must love the dictatorship there. It's remarkable.
It's terrifying is what it is. It's driven many, and I don't include myself in this, but I know many who've gotten out of mainstream media, television or radio, because there were things they couldn't do. I mean, if I'm to be honest, it is my story. I got tired of not being able to speak about certain things and do certain stories and running into arguments with my editor when I began to present as well as produce, and I got out of it. I've spoken to a woman called Anna Brees, who worked for the BBC, worked for ITV. She's gotten out of it. I don't know. What do you think about the advent or this dawn of independent media, where people are kind of breaking away and having these discussions? Because on the one hand, it's a tragedy, and I do say this regularly, so my audience are bored now that I say this all the time. You should be on the 6 o'clock news this evening on the BBC saying what you've said to me, to an audience of maybe a million people or more. But you're not, and that's a tragedy. But you're here, and the audience is sizable, but it's nothing like that. So what about this growth of online independent media in the last few years? Does that give you optimism, Alan? What do you think of it?
I think building up alternative media to the establishment status quo is an absolute must. As I said before, an informed public is the absolute bedrock of democracy. And so if we don't have that, then we can't really call ourselves a democracy. So I very much welcome the advent of the larger independent media channels going on, which are not controlled generally by advertising or one big owner or something who dictates from the top down, but are much more beholden to their viewers or their listeners, because they tend to have a much more diverse range of opinions on show. However, I would say that in the last couple of years, one of the big trends in media is that the powers that be, let's say the establishment journalists, legacy corporations who used to control the means of communication, have tried to start squeezing their grip on the internet by, you know, saying everything is fake news and we have to have new algorithms that will dictate.
That's right.
What is fake and what is real. It's very worrying. There's a big battle going on for the independence of the internet right now.
It's pretty dreadful that. Yeah, I can only speak again for us, but this we've had this on this programme. I interviewed a man who's a Florida State Trooper who made some comments about the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. And I interviewed him 2 years ago. And, you know, I played the devil's advocate and did my job and, you know, robustly interviewed him about his opinions. And that was that, you know, and that was the end of it. And about a year after that, the YouTube channel for this program was deleted immediately with no warnings. And Google got onto us and said, well, the reason is because of, you know, highly offensive programs like that. And in the brief conversation that I was able to have with them, I said, well, look, I've had people like David Duke on the program before, you know, neo-Nazi type people, not for shock value, but to challenge their ideas robustly and to disagree with them. So you're saying I can't speak to people that have said something that might be offensive to the families of the children in Sandy Hook. I can't speak to them even if I challenge the guy and say, well, look, I'm not sure I agree with you. And that seems to be the upside of it. And again, it's not about me, because it's happened to content creators who have far more of a platform and have bigger audiences than I have. But that's a terrifying thing. It was even in the National Press a few weeks ago. Some Labour person came on this programme, and it was in the Mail on Sunday, that it was a bad thing going on the Richie Allen show because 2.5 years ago I interviewed David Duke. Yeah, but I didn't sit here and have a cosy chat with David Duke about how the Holocaust never happened. I had a go at him. You know, it's crazy, Alan. So you're making a very salient point there. On the one hand, it's very good, but if a tiny group like Google, like obviously Google owns YouTube, if they're controlling this advent or this rise of independent media, well, that's something we've got to watch out for.
Yeah, absolutely. We shouldn't trust Silicon Valley corporations to decide what is true and what is false, just as we shouldn't trust the government to do so. I mean, it seems like there's one rule for independent media and one rule for establishment media, because, you know, independent media can get taken down, delisted, deranked, defunded, any of that at a moment's notice. But if say, CNN or whatever publishes something dreadfully fake about Venezuela or about Brexit or about Trump or anything like that, you don't see them losing their blue check mark on Twitter or being suspended or anything like that. There's one rule for the big establishment corporations and others for little, you know, little producers from out of their garage. You know, it's a very worrying time for media.
It is. Final question for today. Thanks for your time today. Are we paving the way for the acceptance of deplatforming in our universities? No better man than you to ask about this. I mean, I laugh and I get a great giggle when I do the monologues talking about stories like a bell being taken out of Cambridge University because the bell might have been on a plantation. Now, again, I don't care who's offended by me saying that. Who could vouch for or who could be in favour of slavery? But this sort of thing, it's not good, is it, Alan? I mean, what about having a discussion about these issues? Or even, I mean, the bell's obviously a very funny, a very kind of unique story, but even the refusal of universities to allow people who've been invited by various other students to come and speak, and then the student union gets involved and says no because that person would offend feminists or would offend whoever, it doesn't matter. That's directly linked to what you've just been talking about, right?
Well, it can be quite a worrying trend. It really depends on, you know, which one's going on. But certainly across universities and academia in general, there's been a loosening of the apparently sacred bond that academics have that they can tell the truth. And some of that's just down to the fact that academics are no longer given long-term contracts. They're no longer protected under contract law. So we're all now on these tiny, sometimes even 0 hours contracts or these very short-term contracts where we really don't have the backing of our institution to say what we want. And that Piers Robinson's a great example of that. He actually had been there for a very long time and was forced out by a media campaign. It's a very worrying time, yeah.
Yeah, I speak with Stuart Waiton from Abertay University quite regularly about issues around free speech and that. And I, you know, I've said to Stuart before, you know, I'd be worried about you up there, you know. And anyway, in fact, he's decided to stand for the Brexit Party, believe it or not. And I'll have him on the programme tomorrow. Dr. Alan McLeod is the author of Bad News from Venezuela and Propaganda in the Information Age. You can find him on Twitter. Do follow him on Twitter. It's at Alan R. McLeod. That's MacLeod. Alan, thanks so much for your time today. I really do appreciate that. I hope you'll come back again in the future.
Yeah, I will. Anytime, Richie.
Thanks, Alan. That was brilliant. Terrific stuff from Alan McLeod. A different take on what's been happening in Venezuela, but also on the media coverage of it and why the media coverage is so uniformed in its kind of condemnation of Maduro and his government. Great stuff from Alan McLeod. It's exactly 6 minutes or 5.5 minutes to the top of the hour. We'll have a musical break. There have been plenty of tweets. I will read them when we come back. Let's have Oasis and Wonderwall. Seems to be flying by today, the old programme. Don't know about you. Back in a couple of minutes.
Richie Allen.
Yes, welcome back to the Richie Allen Show. Here's an interesting story. No, I did say I'd do the tweets. Let's do the tweets there. Before I read that story and before we interview, I shouldn't say interview, before we welcome Dr. E. Michael Jones to the programme, let me read these tweets that have come in there now. There you go. Just to mention again, follow Alan on Twitter. It's at Alan Orr McLeod. That's M-A-C-L-E-O-D. Fantastic name, isn't it? That's a proper surname there, McLeod. Brilliant stuff. Andy Newman enjoyed listening to that. Thank you, Andy. Appreciate that. Let me scroll down there. Hi to Steve James. I'll talk about Yosemite Bolton there. Far from funny. It speaks again to the Trump phenomenon, doesn't it? And the inability of people to put their hands up and say, I was hoodwinked there. Yeah, during the campaign, I believed everything the man said. I bought into it. But I was hoodwinked. People tend to dig and further entrench themselves into their position. Can't be seen to be saying that I got it wrong. Why? Because of their hatred, justified or unjustified. Maybe hatred is never justified. Because they despise people like the Clinton crime cartel. That's why we trusted and believed all the promises made by Donald Trump. I don't know. It doesn't matter what materializes. It doesn't matter what comes to light. People seem to be reluctant to say, well, maybe it's because people are scared, maybe. That's been put to me many times over the years. People have said to me, on programmes now, men and women have said, you know, what is it? Why don't people accept it? That there's no chance in the democratic system. There's no future in the two-party political system, or even the political system full stop. And generally the consensus has been, it's because people are terrified of the alternative. Now the alternative is having to do something about it. Actually having to take action. Because the more you find heroes, whether it's heroes in politics or whether it's heroes in activism, the more you divest yourself of your responsibility to take some control over your life and to take some action against the tyranny that we are kind of sleepwalking into. And I've always believed that. I've believed that when that concept was first put to me many years ago by an academic, funnily enough, on Spanish radio, I concluded that she was right. I said, you're right. It's fear of having to do stuff about it. By believing Jeremy Corbyn or Bernie Sanders or Ocasio-Cortez or any of the rest of them, you then are absolved of any responsibility to take on the system yourself. And that's why you have truth or industrial complex conferences. That's why people go to these things, to meet their heroes. And I get a lot of stick for bringing this up. I'm not trying to hurt anybody or mock anybody. I don't believe the truthers are evil people. They're just opportunists. They see an opportunity to tell people what they want to hear, to keep them sound and safe and cozy in their beds rather than doing anything about it. And I think that's what it is with Donald Trump supporters. You know, if I hadn't been listening to the people I've been listening to for many years, I might have believed the Donald Trump shtick. I might have said, Christ, this is great stuff. This guy, he's talking about no more interventionism, you know. He's talking about you know, he's talking about going after criminals like the Clintons. This is good. He's talked about vaccines. Great stuff, this. Well, get me a plane ticket. I'm going to go to the States and give this guy $500, not that he needs it, and I'm going to work for him. But I've been around the block 500 times, and I've seen it all before. I try to tell people that. I try to say to people, listen, I was hoodwinked, by the way. I was really hoodwinked. I used to believe politicians as well. And I used to stick up for them. And I used to get into arguments that got very heated because I believed in my political parties, which were the Socialist Workers' Party and Sinn Féin and the Workers' Party, as in, I believed all these people. And in those parties, there were nice people. There were one or two individuals. They were okay. But ultimately, they all serve the same masters. When you realise that, well, at least you're halfway there. David tweets, the Trump-Clinton thing is bad cop, worse cop. It is, mate, you're spot on. That's how the Trump supporters see it. Well, she's worse. Well, she might be. She might very well be far worse than her husband. But is that a good reason to stick with somebody or something or some concept? Well, the alternative is worse. You know, 4.5 minutes past the hour. Thanks for those tweets coming in today, by the way. We've got Professor E. Michael Jones from Culture Wars coming on in a couple of minutes' time. Big shout to Dean Smith. How you doing, Dean? What's this I hear about a progressive bell end trying to end a bell? Very good. Very good. Yeah, a bell that might have been, I don't know, manufactured or might have been on a plantation at one time or another must be taken down in Cambridge because it is offensive. These are the stories. Keep the tweets coming in at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. I am going to take some music. I will give a phone call to Dr. E. Michael Jones. I think you're going to find him fascinating. Let's do it so we can have more time with him. And again, I'm sure you'll be motivated to tweet me when he's on the programme. And I'm sure there are things you'd like me to put to him. So do tweet me and I will put those comments and questions and points of view to him as soon as he's on. Right? Right. What have we got lined up? Al Green? Fancy a bit of Al Green, yeah? Al Green it is. Do that to me. Dr. Al Green on the Richie Allen Show. We're approaching 9 minutes past the hour. It's a wet South Manchester. Is it ever any other way? It's wet this Wednesday. It is the 8th of May. Welcome back to the programme. Thanks for all the tweets. Alan McLeod was a terrific guest. We'll invite Alan back again. I have no doubt that you're going to enjoy listening to my next guest. He's a fascinating man. He's the editor of CultureWars.com and he's written many, many books, including The Slaughter of Cities and Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control. He's one of those guests that I regularly get asked to approach. So listeners say, you've got to get this man on the programme. Let's welcome Dr. E. Michael Jones to our show. Dr. Jones, how are you?
Good, Richie. Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
It's fantastic to have you on. Thanks for doing it. Is it a golden era for anthropology? I was thinking about you today. We have gender identity issues never out of the news. We have trans women at war with feminists. We're teaching children that there are 57 identities they can choose from in primary school. Some time to be alive, Dr. Jones, I would have said. These are crazy times.
Yeah, they are. There's no question. I think we're nearing the end of a trajectory that began, I suppose, at the time of the French Revolution, when man decided he was going to take control of his own life. He's going to live by reason alone. No one was going to tell him what to do. And along that period of time, this whole movement got hijacked and turned into a form of control. That's pretty much the basis of my book, Libido Dominandi. It started at the time of the sexual revolution with the Marquis de Sade, who understood how sexual passion could be channeled and turned into a revolutionary movement and could be mobilized to destroy the counter-revolutionary movement that was known as the Vendée. That's when he wrote that famous manifesto of his. So over this period of time, what you've seen is methods of psychological control and manipulation becoming more and more powerful with ever increasing powerful means of communication. And the message has been refined over this period of time to the point where man is in control of his destiny. He can have a government that responds to his interest. He can determine whether he is what is right and what is wrong. Now we're getting into theological area, which is the way Satan tempted Adam and Eve. And now in the final stage, he can determine his own being. This was mentioned in a Supreme Court decision in the United States called Planned Parenthood versus Casey. The mystery of being, defining your own being is the essence of freedom. That's what Justice Kennedy said. So now we're defining our own being. We don't accept anything as a given. The fact that you are a male or a female and there's nothing you can do about it is up for grabs now. That followed fast on the heels of approving homosexuality. And so we have a total attack on the notion of being, the notion of nature, the notion that there's any given. Everything is up for grabs. Now, the problem here is that we all know that's not true. We all know you can't change fundamental aspects of life and nature, but you're given the illusion you can because that is a form of control. What we're talking about is a kind of narcissism that you find among homosexuals. But what now has been expanded to include an entire population of people. And if you're a man, you can become a woman. You can be whatever you want. And this is the illusion that's driving this kind of end game now of the liberation ideology that began, I'd say, with the French Revolution.
Now, we'll come back to homosexuality because I want to ask you, I kind of take a different approach to homosexuality than you do. It'd be interesting to get your thoughts on my thoughts maybe in a few minutes. But I'm fascinated by you saying at some period, man decided that nobody would tell him what to do. And this is really interesting. And you didn't say, Dr. Jones, that this was necessarily a bad thing, man deciding that nobody could tell him what to do. It sounded like you said that once man began to think like that, other interests got involved and kind of hijacked that. So can you explain that? Because I'm fascinated by that, because as a man of religion, or as a man who believes in a creator, I'm kind of fascinated by the idea that you don't have a fundamental problem with man deciding that nobody will tell me what to do.
Well, okay, let me rephrase it. We are going to operate according to reason.
Okay.
Human reason. Okay, that's fine. I agree. We should all operate according to human reason. But who gets to define what reason is? So this was defined at a time when reason was defined in a very truncated sense, namely science, namely physics, mathematics, geometry. It reached its high point in France. It began with René Descartes, who was a geometer, and he kind of simplified the entire universe by saying, you know, there's res extensa, res cogitans, the mind, the universe, it's all mathematical, and that's it. Well, that's not it, okay? There are other aspects of reason out there. And if you reduce it to that, you're giving everyone a distorted understanding of reason. So that notion of reason became basically the ideology of reason. It was called the Enlightenment. And the main opponent of the Enlightenment was the church, the Catholic Church. And the church was an authority in France at that time. There was no separation of church and state. And the Enlightenment was there to overthrow the church in the name of reason. Well, I'm saying this is a false dichotomy. I'm saying the book I'm writing right now is the history of Logos and the Logos of history. I'm saying if you go back to the beginning, what do we have? We have an understanding of Logos that began with the Greeks, that developed with Christianity. Christianity did not impede this understanding of Logos. It enhanced this understanding of Logos to the point where science could only develop in Europe. It did not develop in the Islamic world because you needed an understanding of the Trinity, which was way beyond anything the Greeks could have figured out. But you needed that because you needed some understanding of secondary causality, because without that, you could not understand how the universe operated. I'm saying that the whole Enlightenment ideology was a radical truncation of reason that distorted things to the point where reason became the enemy of the church. And when you destroy the church, you're basically destroying the fabric of culture and the vehicle of Logos throughout history. That's the tragedy of that period, of the Enlightenment.
And before that Enlightenment, you believe that the norm was, forgive me for using pejorative terms like the norm, but that we, how do I say this, that we had a family, and the family was a man and a woman, and they procreated, and the man gathered and foraged and provided for his family, and they grew, and the children went on to have their own families, and that was accepted as right and reasonable. But after the Enlightenment, this began to change.
Well, yeah, I mean, it began, it took a long time, it's over 200 years, but it was people like the Marquis de Sade who basically used Enlightenment principles. He read De La Mettrie's book, L'Homme Machine, The Man, a Machine, and he reduced man to this kind of mechanistic construct. And he did that because he had some type of sexual purpose in mind. Woman was a machine for voluptuousness. He said that in his book. So basically, this radical simplification of human nature to some type of mechanism, which was implicit in Descartes, became explicit with the Marquis de Sade. And at that point, once you disconnected sex from the moral order, from the natural order, it became a form of control, which is what it is today. That's what it is today. Let's be perfectly honest about it. Why do we have pornography? Why is pornography omnipresent? Well, because it's a form of control. It keeps people docile. I began my book, Libido Dominandi, by talking about the Israelis when they came into Ramallah. One of their many invasions of the Palestine, the West Bank, Gaza, they took over the TV station and started broadcasting pornography. Now, why did they do that? Did they want to bring liberation to the Palestinians? That's the American explanation. No, because they admitted by their actions that pornography was a form of control. This is a fundamental fact of life that you have to understand if you want to understand gay marriage or transgenderism or any of the contemporary manifestations.
Yes, I'm fascinated by this. And a lot of what you say, and I've been watching your videos, and I find a lot of, I get a lot of answers to questions that I've been posing to myself for many years from reading you and from listening to you. But I want to talk about homosexuals, gay men and women. And we've got E. Michael Jones, Dr. E. Michael Jones, live on the line today. It's great to have him on the programme, culturewars.com, read his books. I'm not a liberal. I kind of define myself as kind of an old socialist, if that means anything to anybody. And I certainly am no virtue signaller. But I happen, through my work in the media, mainstream media for many years, I know a lot of gay couples. A lot of gay couples. And I don't see any issue with their existence. Now, I'm not saying that you do. I see them as great people, decent people. They build a home together. Most of them have not adopted children. They're productive members of society. Okay, they're not producing children, but they're great people. They mind their own business and they are what they are. And sometimes they hear programs like this and subjects like this have come up before and they think, why are they attacking? And I'm not saying you're attacking gay men and women, but why are we being blamed for some sort of moral decay or moral decline in society? We're not. We just do. We live our lives, we love one another, and we get on with our lives. What do you say to that?
Well, I'm biracial. I'm half Irish and half German. And in both of those groups, people had problems with drinking. And I grew up with drinking being a part of my culture. And I also I spent time in Germany teaching, and drinking was a big part of that culture. And I know people who were alcoholics. Okay, now they were fine people, but they weren't fine people because they were alcoholics. They were fine people in spite of the fact that they were alcoholics. And I could say the same thing about homosexuality. Okay, homosexuality is wrong. It is wrong. It is morally wrong because there is a logos to human sexuality. Logos is another word for practical reason. There is a plan planned into human sexuality, and the essence of human sexuality is male and female. Male and female unite, and out of that union comes another generation of people. That is the basic cell of society. That is the basic armature of human culture and human history. If you deliberately thwart that, you are committing an evil act, okay? And if you commit an evil act, you are less of what you were if you had not committed that evil act. There is no way to get around this fundamental fact.
Let me retort, if you don't mind, Dr. Jones.
Sure.
This is good. Let me retort. I don't believe it's fundamentally evil. And I believe that, and this is my belief from what I've been able to glean from my research over the years, throughout history, there's always been a percentage of society of same-sex couples or people who favour members of the opposite sex. And however miserable this world is today, and I share so many of your opinions as to what's happening and why, I think it's sad, and I'm delighted you're on the programme. Thank God we can have a grown-up conversation about this stuff. I just think it's sad that any bright mind, I mean, you're obviously a great mind, that you would think that it's wrong and evil. They are who they are, and they don't do any harm to anybody. Like I said, I've been lucky enough to know same-sex couples through the years, and I'm not trying to curry favour with anybody. Believe me, I'm a bastard, me. I'll say whatever I feel about anything. They are people, they bother nobody. They certainly don't offend me. You know, I you know, it's funny, I've been asked before, you know, oh, Richie, the sex between two men. And I say, well, look, it would obviously make me uncomfortable and it would turn me off because it's not my thing. But whatever people do in their own homes, it's their own business. And they're good people and they bother nobody. And I think throughout history, there's been evidence that some people favour members of the same sex. And it's always been there. Go ahead, Dr. Jones.
Yeah, well, some people favour alcohol. And they get drunk and they become unproductive members of society. But that doesn't mean we have to promote alcoholism. It's the same type of thing. You can say they don't bother anybody. Well, they do bother people. I mean, it got so bad here in Indiana that the government, the state government, had to pass a law protecting the citizens of Indiana from this predatory homosexual agenda, where people would show up and then wreck your business if you didn't go along with the homosexual agenda. The state had to intervene to protect these people. And when the state did intervene, the CEOs came down on them like a ton of bricks. The head of Salesforce, Mark Benioff, he comes into Indianapolis, swaggers into the state house and says, "You people have to change your law." Well, this is not people being off by themselves, minding their own business. This is now a question of public order. You disagree with the homosexual and you're in trouble.
Now, this is really interesting, because I agree with this, but just park that for a second. This is really fascinating. Because I've seen this in action, but where this is coming from, I think, is up for debate. Let me just put one final argument about gays and lesbians to you, and then I'm going to shut up, because it's all about you today. It's not about me. I don't agree with the analogy with alcoholism. It's great to speak to a fellow Irishman, by the way, even if you're only half an Irishman there, Dr. Jones. But it's good to have you on. As an Irishman, look, I know all about alcohol. I don't think you can make the analogy between alcohol. People choose to drink. Some people are addicted. Some people can be, you know, they can get off it. Others get help and they get off it. I don't believe, and I know you do, but I don't believe that people choose their desires, their sexuality. I think they're born
okay,
with
can
them.
Can I say something?
Well, we can
to
argue
that.
All day about
I,
that. Go
I'm
ahead.
I am not saying that people choose their sexual orientation. The Irishman does not choose his weakness to drink or the biological mechanism that makes drink so attractive to him.
Yeah.
The homosexual does not choose his sexual orientation. He chooses to act on his sexual orientation, just as the alcoholic chooses to take a drink or does not take a drink. I am not saying that the homosexual is responsible
okay,
for his sexual
enough.
Orientation.
I apologize. Thanks for clarifying that. Right, we disagree on that aspect of it. Right, okay. Where I'm inclined to agree with you, and I'm delighted you brought this up, yes, this targeting of businesses and people because they have opinions. Now, I could speak to you for hours. I could speak to you for days and months. I would enjoy listening to you. Doesn't matter if there are things that I disagree with or there are things you disagree with. I would never seek to have you shut down or shut up because I don't agree with you. And I think you've hit on a really important problem that we face today. But where is it coming from? This is very interesting. A gay journalist called Andrew Pearce, who's a conservative, who writes for the Daily Mail. Interesting character is Andrew Pearce. And he's written about this war on people's opinions and people's ideas and their fundamental principled beliefs. And he's a gay man. And he would go to bat for the rights of businesses to, I don't know, for example, not to bake a cake for a same-sex couple or whatever. But he would say, Andrew Pearce, this is not coming from, you know, a so-called gay and lesbian community. I don't know any gay men and women who are out there screaming and demanding that people swear allegiance to gay men and women. He thinks it's coming from something dark or something else. What do you think, Dr. Jones?
I agree with him. I agree with him. There aren't enough homosexuals out there to be a potent political force. We're talking about 1%, 2% of the population. That's not enough. That's not politically significant. The only reason the homosexual now is significant is because he has become the proxy warrior for the oligarchs. That's what our illustrious mayor in South Bend, Indiana, is now running for president of the United States of America. The only reason that someone from an obscure city in Indiana could consider doing this is because he's a homosexual. And the only reason that makes sense is because the homosexual is the proxy warrior for the oligarchs. The oligarchs are always there back there too. 1% of the population. They have all of the wealth and they have virtually all of the power. And the big question is, well, how do we control people? That's the fundamental issue here. How do you control people when you're always a minority? Okay? And this is part of what the homosexual agenda is about. So I agree with the man completely. It's not coming from the homosexuals. It's coming from the oligarchs who are promoting the homosexuals as their proxy warriors.
Really, really good to have you on. It's 28 minutes past the hour. Needless to say, there are dozens and dozens of tweets on this, many of them supportive for what Dr. E. Michael Jones is saying. Check out culturewars.com if you haven't before. He's written some fascinating books, and I think he's a very interesting and I think he's a very important thinker. This is good stuff. Let's leave homosexuality for a minute because you've said some really interesting things. I think you've been really sharp in your writing about things like feminism. And I loved an interview I saw you do recently where you talked about feminism coming to be partly because the oligarchs saw women as an untapped labour resource. This is really fascinating to me. Would you talk about that for a minute?
Yes, I'd be happy to. It's an honour to talk to someone who understands the old left, because now we have the new left, and the new left is all sexual liberation and no talking about economics. Okay? This is the problem. What happened in the 70s was that the oligarchs decided to embark upon new geographies of production and an expanded labor force. Toward the end of the 1970s, this is the run-up to the Reagan-Thatcher era, the oligarchs became unhappy at high wages. They also became unhappy at inflation, which was good for people who were earning wages within reason. And so the counterattack was to basically destroy the living wage, which was the great accomplishment of the American economy after World War II. And how do you destroy this? Well, if you double the workforce, you cut wages in half, theoretically. And that's precisely what they did with feminism. Feminism was basically an operation that set out to lower wages in the interest of oligarchic control of the culture. And once it got accepted, once feminism got accepted, that meant the talk of equal pay for equal work. Who can be against equal pay for equal work? Well, that was not the principle of the economy during the great period, which began when Ford, Henry Ford's grandson, decided to come to an agreement with the UAW in Detroit, which set the trend for wages throughout the United States. The principle there was that the man was the head of the family. The man should earn enough so that he can have his wife stay at home and she can raise the children. That was the principle of the family wage, and that got destroyed by feminism. And now we have a situation where both man and woman have to work in order to achieve what a man alone achieved 50 years ago.
And this must have had, you see, when I was listening to you talk about this, it started sparking off ideas. It's wonderful that, isn't it? It's like throwing a pebble into a pond. As I was listening to you, I started thinking about the impact that might have had on the family and on child rearing, bringing up a child. I once said to a feminist whom I've known for many years, I said to her, look, if you want to go and work for a Fortune 500 company, that's your own business. And I certainly wouldn't want to stand in the way of that. But I asked her this, Dr. Jones. I said, look, do you not think that the most important job that you could ever do, ever, is raise a child? Raise a child to be good and to be decent and to have a chance. Isn't that more important than working in some shitty, excuse my language, company where you're not making anything of any real worth? It's all about money and stock prices and stuff like that. Surely right. The raising of a child right. is... And that's what... Listening to you, it put in my mind that not only were they an untapped labour resource to drive down wages, but it was messing up with raising a child.
Right. Well, I'll give you an incident. I was in New York City. I'm in Washington Square, and I'm sitting on a bench, and everybody talks next to everybody else because it's very densely populated. And there's a woman sitting there, an older woman and a younger woman. And the older woman, I'd say maybe pushing 50, she said to the younger woman, I was sitting on my sofa last night eating my cheese sandwich at midnight, and I burst into tears because I realized my life is over. Well, why is your life over, honey? Well, she got the job that every feminist desires, lusts for. She was a partner in a law firm, or maybe not partner. She was an employee in a law firm. And she worked 70 hours a week, and she made, I'm sure she made a good deal of money, but they extracted every single erg of labor out of that lady so that she had no ability to have a life of her own. And now she's too old to have children. And not only that, she doesn't have any friends anymore either, because all she does is give her labor over to that law firm. Now, this is the untold story about feminism. And this is why did I get married? I'll be married 50 years in August. Why did I get married? Because I wanted a life. I wanted a new life. And I could only have that with a woman and a family, because that's what gives you a life. And what you're doing is depriving people of a life. So to get back to my children, my youngest son is a ballet dancer. He goes to the Cincinnati Ballet, gets a job. He falls in love with another ballerina, and they decide to get married. Now, this violated the unwritten rule of the ballet, which is, and the art world, I'm saying in general, which is basically all relationships should be transient, sterile relationships. That's the situation that we've gotten into right now. This is ruthless exploitation of people, ruthless theft of people's labor, and crumpling them up like Dixie cups and throwing them away. And I'm talking specifically about the ballet, where a woman reaches 35, she's had her career, and now she's too old to have children, and now it's over. That's not fair. That's not fair to the general public, and all of the propaganda that led these people into these lives, like that lady in New York, has done a great disservice, not only to these women, but to society in general.
Really interesting this. I'm not saying that because I'm just, you know, paying lip service. This is fascinating stuff. Gail has tweeted the program. I do agree with Michael Jones' view on feminism, taking mums away from their kids and families breaking down. I don't blame mums wanting to work. I did for quite a while and I enjoyed it, she said. It's a very interesting story in British media today about married couples not having anywhere near as much sex as they used to have, meaning that more and more married couples are not having children at all, or they're leaving it till very late in life. What do you think of that? That speaks to this agenda you're talking about.
One of the most delicate ecological balances in nature is human sexuality. And you start tinkering with it and you'll wreck it. You'll wreck it. And one of the things that the main tinkering that has wrecked sexuality is contraception. Okay. It will destroy your relationship because your relationship is by nature ordered to fertility and ordered to having children. If you deliberately exclude that possibility from your relationship, you will suffer consequences and you won't understand where the consequences come from. And so what we are seeing now is this was the story of the 1960s, especially in America, when the big foundations like the Rockefeller Foundation used fronts like Notre Dame University and Father Hesburgh to basically overturn the church's teaching on contraception. They also used it. 1965 was the crucial year because that was the year in which the Supreme Court struck down the ban on the sale of contraceptives. What we are now seeing is the consequence of making that that invasion into the most intimate sphere of human life. What we're seeing now is the consequences, and one of the consequences is the lack of sexual desire.
The lack of sexual desire. Do you think there are environmental factors playing havoc with people as well? This is a question from our listeners. We're in the technological age, aren't we, Dr. Jones? You've got Wi-Fi technology, what we call non-ionizing radiation. It seems that we're being exposed to all sorts of technologies which might be playing havoc with our feelings, with our thoughts. What do you think of that?
I think the most plausible case here is ladies flushing their birth control pills down the toilet. That goes into all that estrogen goes into the food, into the water supply. It causes havoc with fish. They can't breed properly. And it causes the increase in estrogen among men, which has a feminizing effect. I'm not saying that's the crucial factor, but I'm saying it is. If you're talking about environmental factors, that is clearly an environmental factor. The amount of estrogen in the environment right now.
There's a big department store in the UK called Boots. You might have heard of it. And Boots is huge. It's nationwide. And you get all sorts of stuff there, personal hygiene products, but perfumes as well. It's massive. And recently I was in there and I saw some men being made up. They were having makeup put on. So I did speak to one of the makeup ladies and I said, guys now are having makeup. Now, it didn't come as a revelation to me. I had read about men having makeup put on. And she said, yes. And I said, how recently did you open a makeup stand just for men? And she said, well, fairly recently. And I said, what's the uptake? And she said, well, it's huge. Men are coming in all the time. So then I asked her, and what about the clothes they're wearing? And she said, well, they do wear a lot of very tight clothing and they are increasingly carrying man bags, bags over the shoulder that would resemble the traditional woman's handbag. And again, that was a kind of a light bulb going off over my head, Dr. Jones. I was thinking, well, where is this coming from? But you've given me one of the answers. Estrogen in the water is one of the possible reasons.
Well, also, when you're saying men, are you referring to homosexuals?
No, young straight men. Young straight men who want to be made up, who want to have makeup on. And
well, look, I have said before that even if you're not a homosexual, you're supposed to act like a homosexual in this culture because they are the ideal citizen right now. And a part of that means transient, sterile relationships. So I'm not surprised.
You're not surprised by that. Let me just remind our listeners, you are listening to Dr. E. Michael Jones. Do check out culturewars.com. I'm sure a large proportion of our listeners have heard of Dr. Jones before and have read books like The Slaughter of Cities and Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control. The $64 million question is, how do you put a dent into this? How do you wake people up to what's happening and how dangerous it is for them? I'm talking about the interference with children in primary schools, you know, in terms of trying to bend their minds to think about gender identity and stuff like that. What can we do about it in this crazy world where, as you described, both parents must work, because if they don't, they're going to be on the curb. They can't afford to live. Parents don't have time to counsel their own children. What do we do about it?
Well, let's take a step back here. We are on a river. We're all floating down the same river. The river is known as time and human history. And time and space are a creation of God. And so the first thing you have to understand is that God is in charge of human history. It's called divine providence. So how does God work in human history? He gave us free will. That means we can do evil. Okay? Is that the end of the story? No, God takes evil and he turns it into good. That is the whole story of human history in a nutshell. And that's something that we have to understand. We have to understand that there is good and there is evil. And that even if we commit evil, the plan is still for the good and we can get back on the plan. So I've talked to people. I talked to Roosh got a start in life being the greatest pickup artist in human history. He slept with women all over the world and wrote books about it. And then that one day he woke up and he realized, I'm not happy. And I said to him, there was probably a plan here. You had to learn it all by yourself. You know, you had to learn it in, as Ben Franklin said, experience keeps an expensive school, but fools will learn in no other. So you had to learn it in the expensive school. People before you knew that it was wrong and they avoided it. But you, there's still a plan for your life. And now you're waking up and you realize that's not the way to happiness. There's another way. So this is, I think this is the situation of this generation. I know 20-year-olds who tell me, you know, we grew up with porn accessible on our phones. And now we're realizing it's a form of control because you said so, because you wrote the book. Well, that's true. That's true. I did write the book and that is true. And once you wake up to that fact, you realize, well, maybe I should act in a different way. And I think what we're seeing now is an openness to logos, the order of the universe as God planned it, the order of human sexuality as God planned it. That is the answer to your problems.
What about like me? Sorry, Doctor. What about guys like me who have a lot of respect for many of your arguments? And we disagree about gay and lesbian folks. But that's all right. We can disagree. We're grown ups and we can be respectful. What about a guy like me who takes a lot from you? I take a lot from you. I enjoy reading you, enjoy listening to you. But I don't believe in a divine creator. And don't give me the standard answer now with respect that the creator believes in you. Is not believing in a creator a barrier to understanding this stuff and dealing with it?
Yes. Yes. It's irrational.
Well, I don't think it is.
Atheism, let me be perfectly clear, atheism is irrational. The human mind can know that there is God. It is not an article of faith. It's an article of reason. Okay, so if you're an atheist, you are being irrational. And we don't talk about ontology now. We don't talk about being. We talk about psychology. And I can talk to you about where atheism comes from. It's related to homosexuality in that there are father issues here. Sigmund Freud said God is an exalted father. And he was right, but not in the way he understood. We get our ideas of God from our fathers. Fathers can be, you know, good, bad, and indifferent. Okay? This is, if you want to talk about atheism, that's the discussion you have to have.
Can I have a retort? Can I have a 20-second retort? In fact, if you do come back again in the future, I'd love to have you back in the future. Maybe we can get into atheism. I'm very open-minded. Look, I'm not precious at all about my positions. I never have been. I wouldn't be in radio if I was. Let me have a 20-second retort. And I say this, I say this respectfully to every Christian, to everybody who believes in God. I'm not trying to demean or mock you. I believe that the idea that a divine creator breathed life into us and sent us here to this domain to do good or to do evil for his amusement, I find that irrational. I find it irrational. I can't comprehend it. I would say I am an autonomous, totally individual person who doesn't take, you know, I don't want to be living in some kind of hamster cage where some creator is getting amusement out of me running around. I find that irrational. Back to you, Dr. Jones.
you're taking it a couple steps too far down the road. The first question is, why is there anything? Because creation is the creation of something. Okay? You can first you have to show that God created something, that God created this world. Okay? Nothing comes from nothing. There is something. Therefore, there was never nothing. This something could not bring itself into existence because it would have to exist before it existed, which is impossible. Therefore, something else had to bring it into existence, and that something is what all men call God. That's the fundamental starting point. At that point, you have to say, okay, there is something called God. Now, whether he believes in hamster cages or you running around or whatever it is, that all comes after the fact. That's the first fundamental fact that we have to establish here. That's what we have to establish.
Yeah, but I don't believe it. That's the thing. I don't. I have great respect for, and you make the argument very elegantly, eloquently even, and elegantly. And you've got a big old brain on you there, bigger than mine. But I just don't believe it. And I don't see it being a barrier to my understanding of things, because much of what you say about how we're being controlled, I agree with you. I think you're brilliant. I think you're absolutely right on. And yet I didn't have to believe in a creator to conclude that, to understand it.
You know, your will is free. Yeah. I'm just saying that if you deny what I just said, you're being irrational. Reason can access that fact. And if you deny that fact, if you deliberately deny that fact, then you're heading down a road where you will end up like Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens or Daniel Dennett, and you will be in deep irrationality. These are some of the most irrational people I have ever experienced in my entire life.
Well, they're dreadful people. Dawkins is dreadful. Dawkins is dreadful because he's ignorant and he's obtuse. And
he's a bigot, and he hectors you, and he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's an ignoramus when it comes to philosophy. He thinks he knows everything. He doesn't know anything when it comes to philosophy. The only philosopher among the group was Daniel Dennett, and he said, the universe created itself out of nothing or something very small. Now, that has to be one of the stupidest statements in the history of the human race.
I'll go along with that. I'll go along with you.
Yeah. Stupid.
It is stupid. I should really rebrand myself as agnostic, because I can't just say that I rule out some intelligent design. I can't say that. I'd be stupid. I'd be like Richard Dawkins. And these people are ignorant, they're rude, they're horrible, and they have no interest in, you know, trying to understand the rationality of anybody else. And I don't know how you define these people, but they're dreadful. They're not intellectuals. I agree with you. I don't like them at all. There's been a massive response to you being on the programme on Twitter, and we've only got about 5 or 6 more minutes on the programme today. I hope in the future, in a few months' time, you'll you'll come back to us and do maybe a longer stint, Dr. Jones, because it's been brilliant.
I would be happy to. I'm writing the book on Logos.
This is the Indiana guy.
I'm trying to initiate a universal conversation that anyone in the world can take part in, simply because we are all rational creatures. That's the fundamental conversation I'd like to initiate.
Absolutely. This guy's the presidential candidate, and I'm fascinated by that, and I look forward to reading that. I'm going to read a comment by a listener. I've read some complimentary stuff. Here's a comment from Paul. He says, where does Dr. Jones get this moral authority to dictate what is good or evil? He's being reactionary. Where's his humility if he's so religious? That's from Paul on Twitter.
Look, the essence of humility is that I accept a standard outside of myself, not only as the norm of my behavior, but as the norm of everybody's behavior. There is a universal norm out there. It's not my norm. I didn't create it. I subject myself to it. And I'm saying that everyone has to subject themselves to it, because this is what rationality is. It's practical reason. The mind can know right and wrong. And I'm saying we all know what it is, and it's our duty to conform our lives to that objective standard. That's what Logos is.
Well, I'm not going to be stupid and respond to that. I'm going to leave that be the final word today, Dr. Jones. I want to mention again, it's culturewars.com, and you can also follow Dr. E. Michael Jones on Twitter. I've tweeted out that link, by the way. It is at E. Michael Jones 1 on Twitter, and culturewars.com, where you will find links to the books. It's been a terrific conversation. I've loved having you on. And I want to just mark something. You said, and I'm guessing because of the account you're using, I guess your wife is Ruth, and you've been with Ruth 50 years, is that right?
In August, we will celebrate our 50th wedding anniversary.
Fantastic. I would imagine there were some bumps along the way, but it's been amazing, right?
We're still together.
Fantastic.
It's been quite an interesting 50 years, I guarantee you that.
Brilliant. Dr. E. Michael Jones, thanks for your time today. CultureWars.com. Enjoy the rest of your day and please come back. Lovely
Thank
to
you.
Have you. Bye for now. Dr. E. Michael Jones, live on the Richie Allen Show from Philadelphia, I believe, today. Or is he in Indiana? No, I think it's Philadelphia today. And that was very interesting. His books, The Slaughter of Cities and Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control. He's written many books on his insights and his thoughts on culture wars and the sexual revolution and Judaism and religion and all the rest of it. But fascinating. I'm glad he came on. Let's read some tweets. Rich tweets. How you doing, Rich? Just because the science hasn't been proved doesn't mean that a creator exists. That is irrational, says Rich. Thank you, Rich. Moinga tweets, whether or not we agree with Dr. Jones, I find him intriguing and captivating. Get him back on, says Moinga. Echoed by Diane, who said it's good, all right, listening to him. William says it's interesting stuff. Patricia tweets, the sad truth is that a woman has to decide, do I want children or do I want a career? Usually a man never has to make that choice. I would suggest that a woman simply has to decide what her priority is. When doing both, one of them will suffer. It isn't easy, says Patricia. Thanks for that, Patricia. Faisal tweets, atheism starts off irrational by defining itself by why it... Excuse me. Faisal tweets, atheism starts off irrational by defining itself by what it does not believe in instead of what it does. It is like saying, I do not believe in X, and not knowing how you define X, says Faisal. Thanks, Faisal. Andy tweets, Dr. E. Michael Jones suffers from the American disease, religion, he says. Cheers for that, Michael. Andy, a lot of tweets are coming in on this. I'm not going to get to read them all, but I'm not selectively picking them, by the way. So there you go. Chris Morell tweets, how you doing, Chris? The universe is made real and manifest by our thoughts about it. That's sort of a quote from Professor Brian Cox that I like. Yeah, and that's where I come in on it. And while I must admit that it was people like David Icke that got to me thinking about the simulation theory, it's not David Icke's theory. A lot of people mistakenly believe that David Icke came up with the holographic universe theory. He didn't. He did not. People say all the time, oh, no. He's taken it on. And he's researched it and he's taken it on, but it's not his theory. But it was him that got me into it. And I looked into it and people have been writing about the simulation since the 1970s. And I like the theory. You know, time isn't linear. I like that as well. I like the notion that maybe in the future, some future version of ourselves created the theory. Money Seekers Records says the guy got knowledge, meaning that he is impressed by the comments of Professor E. Michael Jones on the programme tonight. There you go. Really interesting stuff. I enjoyed it. Fascinating stuff. And he's up for a debate. I like that. Right, that's about it, I think. I'm back with you tomorrow. I did mention, speaking of academics, we've been snowed with academics this week. Stuart Wayton, PhD, Dr. Stuart Wayton from Abertay University, who's done extraordinarily brilliant work on identity politics and the creation of vulnerable groups. Stuart is going to run for the Brexit Party. He's going to run for MEP, and that's really interesting, that. And a couple of newspapers in Scotland have had a pop at him. So he's going to come on the programme tomorrow and talk about it. That's Thursday's programme. And I look forward to that. There was something else to say to you. There always is. and it might have gone out of my mind. Just to briefly say, I'm going to be away for a few days next week. Now don't panic, and don't cancel your £1 a month subscription, because I'll find you and I'll shout at you very loudly. We're moving house. There's a little bit of a story behind it. I'll tell you tomorrow if I get time. I'll make time tomorrow to tell you. So we're moving to another place in Greater Manchester. We're not being run out of where we are. It's an economically sound thing. Where we are is unbelievably expensive, and we've taken steps to make life more economically viable for ourselves. And we've been doing this, well, we've been putting this together for months, and now we're about to move. Paul Ripley from Fab Radio is here today. Paul is my engineer, one of the finest men you could ever meet in your life. Real gentleman. And we're going to move next week. We take possession of the house that we're moving to next week, and we're going to move. That's going to take a bit of time, but putting this studio there is going to take a few days. So I'll be off air. What I'll try and do, even in the madness, even in the crazy madness, is I'll try and do one or two live streams on YouTube and put the live chat on so we can have a chat. But the radio show, for a week anyway, for 4 or 5 days, is going to be impossible to do. But Paul's going to get it up and running as quick as he can. Usually takes about 2 days to build a studio. I've put pictures online before. This is not the Mickey Mouse bullshitter on YouTube, shouter on a soapbox kind of thing. This is real radio. This is a real BBC standard studio here. So it's got to be disassembled and reassembled somewhere else. We don't have thousands of pounds to get engineers to do it. So Paul Ripley's going to do it, and it's going to take him a little bit of time, right? Right, if I explained that sufficiently, I think I have. Thank you to my guests. I loved listening to Alan McLeod, PhD, about Venezuela. And I really enjoyed as well speaking with Dr. E. Michael Jones. We'll have Dr. Jones back again. Isn't it good to have a bit of banter? Going to leave you with some Status Quo. Enjoy the rest of your Wednesday. I've been Richie Allen. Get your air guitars at the ready. Enjoy the rest of your day, right? Speak to you tomorrow at 5. Until then, it's bye for me. Bye now.